Human Depravity, Part 3, the eighth talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 31, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I face an interesting challenge this morning. I didn't bring my real Bible because I had my own translation, except I didn't bring my own translation. So we'll go by memory and see what happens. In what I called paragraph 9, last couple weeks, we've talked about the statement that he makes that something to the effect that paragraph 9 says, because what can be known about God is evident among them, God has made it evident to them, from the creation of the cosmos, his invisible attributes are understood by way of the things he created. His eternal power and deity is clearly seen, with the result that they are without a defense. Because while they knew God, they did not acknowledge his glory as God nor respond in gratitude. Rather, they became unintelligently futile in their reasonings, and their ignorant heart was darkened. I have a couple of questions left over that I want to address briefly. I mentioned last couple weeks that I think what lies behind what Paul is talking about here is the human mind's ability to intuitively, to tacitly, unconsciously, if you will, take in all kinds of information and process it and come up with a valid rational conclusion. So I talked about the power of intuition, and that I think what he's talking about here is basically our intuitive conclusion that we reach by looking at nature, by looking at the created order, that there has to be a wise, intelligent, good creator behind it. In the process of talking about intuition, I think some questions arose for a lot of people. As magical as intuition can seem to be, and part of the thing that we need to recognize is it's not magical, it's just rational, but it's the mind operating at a different level, at a different speed, tacitly and unconsciously. So there's nothing really magical about it, it's just reason. But it manages to come up with conclusions and hunches and intuitions that, while rationally valid, we ourselves could not articulate how we know that, because we haven't gone through the plodding step-by-step deduction and inference that gets us there. There is a way that can be abused, however, and I wanted to, that question came up, because I think some people understood me to be saying that the intuition is infallible. The intuition is not infallible, any more than any other form of human reasoning is infallible. We make mistakes. We start with wrong assumptions. We have the wrong paradigm, the wrong worldview that we're reasoning out of. It doesn't matter whether we're reasoning in plotting logical steps or quickly through intuition. The same wrong beliefs can lead to wrong conclusions either way. So there's nothing infallible about the intuition. That was not the point I was making. The point I was making is that just because we can't articulate something clearly doesn't mean that it's not a perfectly rational conclusion. The way people can abuse that is in relationships where they're wanting to do some kind of power trip on somebody else. They can appeal to intuition and say, I don't have to defend myself. I don't have to give you an account. I don't have to demonstrate to you that I'm right. I just know that I'm right, and I just know it. In Christian circles, oftentimes, it comes from somebody claiming some kind of giftedness. I have the gift of prophecy, so you have to listen to me. That can be incredibly abusive. So we have to, as always, take care to live responsibly with those things that are, in fact, true in human reality. Intuition is a valid way of knowing, but it's not infallible, and we have to remember that. The other thing here in paragraph 9, in sentence 5, rather they became unintelligently futile in their reasonings, and their ignorant heart was darkened. Now, I have contended throughout here that the wrong way to read what Paul is saying here is that because we rebelled against God, God stepped in and punitively did something to us. That God punitively stupefied us and made us dumber and made us foolish. It's not what he's saying, I don't think. We made us foolish. We are the ones who darkened our heart. So the question that came up, well, what about the passive voice? Rather, they became unintelligently futile in their reasonings, and their ignorant heart was darkened by something. Why not God? Why am I not reading that to be God, who's the one who's darkening the heart? Well, throughout this section, and I would argue actually not infrequently in Romans, Paul will often use the passive voice when what is being described is something that we have done, a choice that we have made that has consequences on us. So their ignorant heart was darkened by themselves. Their ignorant heart was darkened by their own choice. It's perhaps easiest to see that down in paragraph 10, sentence 2, for this very reason, God abandoned them to impurity in the desires of their hearts, with the result that they dishonored their bodies among themselves. Passive voice, they are the ones being affected, but they're also the ones doing it. They're also the ones making the choice that is dishonoring them, namely by following the impurity of the desires in their hearts. That happens half a dozen times throughout this paragraph where he uses the passive voice, and yet the result is a consequence of their own choice and their own action and their own orientation. I think the purpose for the passive is to probably throw the emphasis onto the result. The result is they had darkened hearts. The result is they had dishonored bodies and so on. Another question that came up is in 10, claiming to be wise, they responded like ignorant fools and swapped the glory of the incorruptible God for an image that was the representation of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed beasts and of crawling reptiles. Now, granted, on the surface, it sounds like what he's really objecting to is you really worship a snake, you really worship a piece of rock, you really worship a picture. I mean, that's silly, and it's true that's silly. The point I was trying to make last week, are there polytheists, heathens, pagans, who maybe really believe that that little statuette that they carry around with them is their god or their goddess? Are there such people? I'm sure there are. Most religions operate at two levels. There's it at the philosophical level and at the folk level, I mean folk religion. Christianity is a very sober and serious confrontation with the truth as revealed in the scripture on the one hand, but most of Christian culture is folk Christianity. It's a folk religion filled with all kinds of superstitions, all kinds of weird beliefs, all kinds of weird practices. But human beings left to themselves are always going to turn their religious beliefs into ritualistic, liturgical, and superstitious belief system. In Christianity and in heathenism, same thing. So I'm sure there are polytheists who did silly things like believe the rock in their pocket was their god. That's probably true. But I think Paul's critique is more serious than that, in that it's possible at the philosophical level there were polytheists who didn't believe that stone statue in their pocket was a god. What they believed is that was a token of a transcendent being who was their god. Now, the polytheists did not have the concept of transcendence that you find in the Bible. In the Bible, the God of the Bible transcends not only my material physical existence, not only mundane ordinary existence, but actually transcends all of being itself, all of reality itself. It lay out and spell out everything that exists, and God will be above that and beyond that as the author of all of that. It's a radically different, profoundly different concept of transcendence than you find in any other worldview. It's in fact, I think it's unique. Well, maybe not. But the polytheists did believe that their gods and their goddesses rose above the ordinary and mundane affairs of their life, and that their gods and their goddesses were the forces that impinged upon ordinary, mundane, everyday life and controlled it and shaped it and directed it by their actions and their wills and their desires and so on. I think Paul's ultimate problem with that, as philosophically viable as that might be and as philosophically sophisticated as that actually might be, Paul's rejection of it is that it worships and serves the creation rather than the creator. Now, not because they're worshiping snakes rather than God. I think his problem is, if you're worshiping a snake, you're not worshiping an eagle or a giraffe or an elephant or a zebra. I mean, what you are saying is that your God has limited and finite attributes that can be symbolized by the snake, or limited and finite attributes that can be symbolized by the eagle, or whatever. What that means is, ultimately, your God is a finite God. Your God is one of the reality-shaping forces in the universe among many, among others. In other words, your gods are simply the dynamics of nature itself, the creation, the dynamics of the creation itself. You don't have a concept that there's a God that rises above nature and controls all of nature. The biblical perspective is not that the gods and goddesses of the heathens don't exist. The perspective of the Bible is they do, and they find the ground of their existence in Yahweh, the God who is. Does the wind blow things? Yes, but not unless Yahweh wills it. Does the lightning strike? Yes, but not unless Yahweh wills it. Does the rain water the crops? Yes, but not unless Yahweh wills it. So instead of having all kinds of different gods, the God of the rain, the God of the wind, the God of the lightning, and right on down the line, as these forces of nature that control our lives and shapes our lives and determine our destiny, instead of seeing a whole set of such reality-shaping forces, the Old Testament prophets taught us to believe that there's one and only one God who transcends all of nature, all of reality, all of being, and wills all of it to be. That's what Paul is ultimately objecting to. And I think he's rightly recognizing that my tacit intuition about where all this came from is only finally satisfied by the kind of transcendent monotheism that the Bible teaches. Polytheism just doesn't adequately explain reality as we know it. But yet, the most common impulse of mankind is to identify the ultimate forces to be just the dynamic forces within the creation itself, not something that transcends the creation. And that's what I think he's ultimately objecting to in 10. And it's as much using sophisticated philosophical polytheism as example of our degradation as it is silly, superstitious folk religion as a evidence of our degradation. Okay. Oh, interestingly, he uses the same word here in this passage when he's talking about images of God that are in the representation of snakes and so on. The same word that Paul will later use in Colossians when he says of Jesus that he is the image of the invisible God. In effect, what Paul seems to think is that there is one token, there is one image that is valid because it's given to us by God himself. And that image is his son. When God became a man in the form of Jesus, he just was God picturing himself to us in a way that he believed was accurate and faithful representation of who he is. That's interesting. He's not against all images, just our man-made images, our misconception of who God is. Okay, briefly, in 10:2, for this very reason, God abandoned them to impurity in the desires of their hearts, with the result that they dishonored their bodies among themselves. As was pointed out to me, it's not really their bodies that are being dishonored, it's their persons that are being dishonored. And I think the way to understand that is the relationship between the body and the person, that Paul as a Jew would have fully been willing to make that equation, that it's not that the true me is a disembodied me, a spiritual me, an invisible me. Persons are always embodied persons in Jewish thought and in truly biblical thought. It's only when you get Plato added to Christianity that you have this bifurcation of body and spirit, and they go their separate ways. Okay, finally, the question did come up, what exactly was going on in Rome at this time? He mentions female homosexuality and male homosexuality. What were the practices? What was going on that he has in view when he makes this claim? I did try to do a little research, and basically I don't think anybody knows what it comes right down to it. There's not a lot of literary evidence of, certainly not of lesbianism, and it's not very clear evidence of what the practices were among the Romans with respect to homosexuality. But so I don't know, frankly. But I don't think it matters to Paul's argument, because I'll explain this a little further later, but it only takes one notorious practitioner of homosexuality in the Roman Empire in order for Paul to make the point that he's making. So I don't think it requires that it be widespread practices. Emperor Claudius, who would have been the emperor just prior to this letter being written, he had a notorious wife, Messalina. Messalina was incredibly immoral sexually and was known for her sexual exploits within the household of emperor. It's hard to sort out fact from legend when it comes to her, because she was so notorious, but she is claimed to have once had a contest with a prostitute to see how many liaisons she could have in one evening. Whether that involved, it's in all likelihood, it involved homosexuality as well as heterosexuality. So you had this prominent, well-known figure who was debauched, you know, was sexually degraded. If she was the only practicing lesbian in Rome at the time, she's available for Paul to make the point that he's making in this passage. I'll explain that in a moment. I'll explain that now. What exactly is the relevance of Paul of reading a list of evils here in 10 and in 11, especially in paragraph 10 and 11, some of which, in fact, 11 gets uncomfortably close to me, but especially if I stick with 10, I have never been an idolater, I'm not a homosexual. Why is that of any relevance to me? Well, the relevance, I think, is the nature of Paul's argument. Paul is assuming that we are all made of the same stuff. Every human being on the planet is a child of Adam and Eve. Every human being on the planet is made of the same stuff. The very fabric of our being morally is identical to any other human being. If that's true, then if Gentile pagans are foolish idolaters and sexually rebellious homosexuals, it illustrates the radical and dramatic depths of human hostility to God and his purposes and his values. And what it illustrates then is what's in the fabric of my being. Not just the fabric of their being, but what's in the fabric of my being. because as go they, so go I. As they demonstrate that they are, that's what I am. Now, that's basically just an assumption on his part. I think it's a valid assumption on his part. I think it's a profoundly insightful assumption on his part. But that's what's necessary in order to understand what he's doing here. So he's trotting out these practices that he that from his perspective should be obvious to everyone who reflects on them, that they are not what the Creator intended. God did not intend for us to be idolaters. God did not intend for us to be homosexual. God did not intend for us to be murderers, liars, all the stuff in paragraph 11. That they are all perverse. They are all a twisting of God's purposes for a human being. And yet, we can see human beings who've gone there. So why have they gone there and I have not? Is it because I'm better than they are? I'm a gooder person than they are? Is that the issue? Or am I seeing in them the deep realities of who I am? And Paul's position would be, you are seeing in them, no matter who they are, no matter how outrageous their behavior, you're seeing what you yourself are made of. That's his point. Now, on the surface, an objection could be raised. But I know myself, and there's just certain things that are unthinkable to me. I may kill you, but I sure ain't going to eat you. That's just unthinkable to me. I don't follow the news, so I've only got bits and pieces of this, but the woman who took her own children and threw them over the bridge up in Portland, I would look at that and I go, I don't care what kind of pressure I'm under. I cannot imagine me doing that. I can't imagine my wife doing that. That's just unthinkable. Well, to understand, I think, Paul's argument, though, we need to understand there's two things that could enter into making something thinkable or unthinkable as a behavior and as practice. We have to think about ourselves at the level of of what I've called the fabric of our being, at our fundamental foundational moral nature. There's who we are at that level. But then overlaying that is conscience, tastes, personal values, personal commitments. And that's overlaid over our foundational moral nature. Well, my conscience, my tastes, my personal values, and my personal commitments, at that level, things can be unthinkable to me. I have just too deeply ingrained in my moral commitments certain things that rule out behaviors. I have too deeply ingrained in my conscience a warning light that keeps me away from certain practices. I have personal values that would be too violently violated by certain practices. So I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to go there. And that's what we experience when we read about these horrific things that so go against our personal values. We can't even imagine not having those values. And those behaviors become unthinkable to us. But I would argue that none of the things in paragraph 10 and paragraph 11 are unthinkable insofar as my foundational moral nature is concerned. They're not unthinkable at that level. They're unthinkable at the level of my values, my commitments, and my conscience. But what if those were to go away? What if you retrained your conscience? What if something eroded your personal values? What if those go away? Then who are you? Then what are you capable of? What's there in the foundational fabric of your being? That's Paul's point. When you see other human beings who don't have your conscience, who don't have your commitments, who don't have your tastes, who don't have your values, then you see what you would be like if you didn't have your conscience, your values, your commitments, and your tastes. Now you're going to see yourself laid bare for the evil, depraved person that you actually are. That's the structure of his argument. He thinks that these examples that he's pointing to lay us all bare so that we can see who we really are in and of ourselves if you take enculturation and civilization away from us. I think I've already said this, but we see people, we know stories of people who start off with a conscience that's been trained by their religious training or whatever, who at some point or another make a deliberate choice to go another way, to violate their conscience. And what happens? Over time, their conscience is muted. Their conscience is silenced. Their conscience is literally transformed. So that what at one point would have been guilt-inducing ceases to be guilt-inducing to them. As he will put it in Timothy, they have seared their conscience. Okay. So I want to finish up paragraph 10 here. Let me read it all again now. Claiming to be wise, they responded like ignorant fools and swapped the glory of the incorruptible God for an image that was the representation of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed beasts and of crawling reptiles. For this very reason, God abandoned them to impurity and the desires of their hearts, with the result that they dishonored their bodies among themselves. These very people swapped the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who, it is certainly so, is eternally praiseworthy. On account of this, God gave them over to degrading passions. In fact, their women, on the one hand, swapped their natural desire for sexual intimacy for one that was against nature. Similarly, the men also, forsaking their natural desire for sexual intimacy with women, were consumed by their lust toward one another, males committing a shameful act with males, and were bringing upon themselves the penalty that was required of their error. We talked about most of that, but I wanted to dwell a little bit on the whole idea that homosexuality is against nature and explore that a little bit more. I think it's important to recognize that what he means by against nature is not against the stuff that you see stories on in the Nature Channel. It's not against nature. It's against human nature is what he has in mind. So it makes no difference whether you can find homosexually practicing animals or reptiles or turtles or monkeys or whatever. That is utterly irrelevant to Paul's point. Because Paul's point is, to the extent that we as human beings know ourselves and understand our own nature, that not only includes anatomy and physiology, but it includes psychology, the psychology of human sexuality, that when you take all the information into account in what makes a human being, what makes sexuality meaningful to a human being as opposed to an animal, when you take all that into account, Paul thinks it should be obvious what God's purposes are. And notice Paul is making basically a natural law argument, that there are certain ordered structures to God's creation, and you can read off God's purposes to some extent from the order and structure of the created order. So we can know something about what God intended human sexuality to be by the facts and realities of human sexual experience. We can come to understand what that was for. That's what he means by nature. Therefore, when he thinks that it should be obvious and apparent that homosexuality violates the purposes that God had in mind for human sexuality. So he's making a different point about homosexuality than he would adultery or prostitution or rape or something of that. Adultery, prostitution, and rape are just as perverse as homosexuality. And there are others that are just as perverse as homosexuality. And Paul would certainly argue that our moral judgment should judge them to be wrong. But he would make a different argument. They're not against nature in the same way and in the same sense that he means homosexuality is here. The wrongness of them is not obvious from human anatomy, physiology, and psychology. It's the wrongness of them is obvious from moral judgment, from ordinary moral judgment. But Paul is saying here that before one even gets to the point of making a moral judgment, the unnaturalness of homosexuality should be obvious on the face of it. I think that's the argument he's making here. And yet, we do it. And yet, we practice it. Rebelling against the very purpose of sexuality that was built into it by God himself. The current climate, the current culture's willingness to embrace homosexuality as readily as it has and is, I think is a clear evidence of how deeply confused we have become in modern culture, how profoundly foolish we have become. It's really alarming to me in a way when I see how much groupthink is going on, how much we are herd-minded in our moral values these days. As long as I've got a couple other dozen people who agree with me, that must justify it. And if everybody else out there is thinking this way, then maybe I ought to think that way as well. Just have some Hollywood movie or TV portray a behavior as normal, and to the typical American these days, it must be normal then. It becomes normal because I saw it on TV portrayed that way. But we're disciples of Jesus. It ought not to be so among us. Nietzsche, who is hardly a friend of Christianity, despised the herd, despised the groupthink, the conforming to everyone else around you kind of sickness that he saw in human beings. And accordingly, he had a love-hate relationship with Jesus. He hated him for his morality, but he loved him for his fierce independence. And he's seen something there that we need to see. If we are going to be disciples of Jesus, we need to be fiercely independent, fiercely independent. We don't think like the rest of the world thinks just because it's more convenient and easier to think like they think. We need to decide what's true based on what our Lord teaches. What does the Bible say? What does the Bible teach? And I know that's embarrassing. I know it's embarrassing to go out there and say, well, the Bible teaches this, therefore it must be true, because you have all these idiots saying that who never read the Bible, who haven't the foggiest idea what the Bible is teaching. So I know that it's embarrassing, but we don't really have a choice. It is the case that if the Bible teaches it, it's true. And if we don't know how and why it's true, then we need to think harder. We need to work on it. But that's the kind of independence, the kind of reoriented dependence onto God, onto God's revelation, onto God's truth, onto God's Son and his teaching that we need to have if we're truly going to be his disciples. It's going to make us hated and misunderstood, that's true, but that's just part of the job description. You know, we don't really have a choice to not be persecuted. As Jesus said, if they persecuted me, you can bet they're going to persecute you. That was the original Greek. It's alarming how willing we are to be shaped by propaganda. And the propaganda technique propaganda campaign with respect to homosexuality, they pulled out all the stops. It is incredible out there. But we must not be played like marionettes. We have to be resistant to the propaganda. Jacques Ellul, in his book Propaganda, says it's educated people who are most susceptible to propaganda. Because as educated people, we've been taught to want to have answers, to want to know, to want to be enlightened, to want to be in a position to have the enlightened point of view and an enlightened perspective. And there are all kinds of propagandists out there willing to give you the enlightened view and give you the answers and take a complex situation that no human being may be able to sort out and simplify it with a slogan or a bumper sticker for you. And we in our culture have got to the point where we think in bumper stickers. I mean, it's uncanny in the political, during the political season, If you ask people why they're voting for the candidate they're voting for, or why they're voting against or for a measure that they're voting for or against, if you hear people interviewed on TV, you get exactly the same answer from everybody answering it. It's what somebody told them. I know, just say this if anybody asks you why you vote for it. This will work. Don't think about it. Don't analyze it. Just give the right answer that makes you look enlightened, makes you look clever, makes you look informed, makes you look wise, and good as well. Well, when it comes to homosexuality, all those buttons are pushed in us. The propaganda is that there's an analogy between being homosexual and being left-handed, or being born with dark skin rather than light skin, that being homosexual is just a result of nature and biology and genetics, and surely you don't want to in any way reject or marginalize or say mean things about people who can't help who they are. That's the propaganda. That's clearly not Paul's perspective here. Paul's perspective here is that all human evil is ultimately rooted in our willful rebellion against the Creator. The argument that is often given is, well, I know somebody who's a homosexual, and they say that they had homosexual desires and tendencies from their earliest memories. That may be. I don't know. I mean, I can say neither here nor there. If they say so, I will trust them. I will believe them. But why is that relevant? I can remember being pugnacious from my earliest memories. If I didn't like something, I'd fight. I know there are people who have started lying from their earliest memories. How many of us were selfish from our earliest memories? I mean, why is that relevant? What the Bible is saying is my depravity is in the fabric of my being. It's right at the heart of who I am from the very foundations of who I am. So no wonder it shows up in my earliest memories. How could it not? Why would it not? That doesn't mean that homosexuality is natural or purposed by God or given by God any more than depravity itself is purposed by God and given by God. The other myth is that my behaviors are actually determined by my genes, and there has been a search for the gay gene by researchers. I don't know if you noticed, just last week or the week before, there was an article that the American Psychological Association, is that what it's called, has rewritten its manual and has said that there is no evidence of any genetic gene or any source for homosexuality, a reversal from what they had said in the last decade. With all this search for the homosexual gene, they have not found it. There's a book I read years ago called The Exploding the Gene Myth. It's probably out of print. I don't know if you can get it, but it was a very fascinating book. The woman who wrote it was a geneticist, but she was also a feminist and a lesbian. And her concern was, she had two concerns, basically. One was political and one was scientific. At the scientific level, she was just saying, this is absurd. Genes don't cause behavior. Never have, never will. Genes make proteins. Genes are the pattern, the template for proteins to be formed and be the building blocks for the body. Human behavior is much more complex than just what proteins you have in your body. And of course, of all people, I mean, it's one thing for that culture out there to believe in genetic determinism because they have been inculcated in that kind of view of reality in all of their schooling. Nature is all that exists. Matter and energy is all that exists. And everything that is determined by the laws of physics and chemistry, so even human behavior is determined by the laws of physics and chemistry. I understand pagans believing that. But we're Christians. Free will is fundamental to our worldview. The freedom of a human being to transcend chemistry and physics and make choices that define who I am, not my molecules, but who I am, my spirit, my person, myself. Myself is formed in freedom by free choices, by a free moral agent. That is so foundational to everything the Bible teaches. There's no, if that's not true, none of this is true. I'm pointing to the Bible. if human freedom is not real, then our whole faith is a joke. It's just a bizarre joke. So it is so fundamental and so foundational to what we believe that certainly we should not be suckered into a worldview that says, no, everything is determined. And the reason homosexuals are homosexuals is because their genes made them do it. That can't possibly be true. So this woman's book, she says, first of all, scientifically, it makes absolutely no sense to say that genes cause homosexuality. And secondly, and here's her social political concern, if genes do cause homosexual behavior, when Hitler comes along again, we're going to be wiped out. Or somebody who doesn't like homosexuals comes along again, he's going to try to cleanse the gene pool. I don't think we want to be spreading the message out there that we have defective genes. Very fascinating book, and it's I'm not sure, but it seems to me that in the propaganda they're beginning to lighten up on the genetic determinism part, maybe for this very reason. So all that's to say, we have tons of propaganda around us, but we just have to resist it. We have to be fiercely independent as Jesus was and think for ourselves, think with your Bible, think in obedience to the Lord. Okay, I want to finish. I'm going to look at paragraph 11 then, and we'll call it a day. In paragraph 11, then, he goes on, inasmuch as they did not judge God worthy to include in their understanding, God abandoned them to their defective mind so that they did those things that were not appropriate, having been filled with all unrighteousness, evil, self-exaltation, wrongdoing. God abandoned them to being full of envy, murder, contentiousness, deceit, malice. God abandoned them to being manipulative liars, slanderers, haters of God, insolent people with an exaggerated sense of their importance, people puffed up with self-delusion, pretenders, inventors of evil, those who are disobedient to parents, people who are ignorant, people who are utterly faithless and untrustworthy, people unaffected by normal human feeling and compassion, people who are implacable, people who utterly lack mercy. And while they understand the demands of God's justice, that people who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do they do these same things, but they also grant approval to those who practice such things. He has a play on words here that it's impossible to capture in the English translation as he starts off 11. Inasmuch as they did not judge God worthy to include it in their understanding, the word he uses is, inasmuch as they did not judge God dokimos, to be held in their understanding, then God abandoned them to a not dokimos mind. So there's a play on words. Dokimos has to do with when something has been tested in order to evaluate it, and then it can just be neutrally. Anytime you evaluate something, you have dokimazoed it. But if it passes the test, often the word dokimos is used to describe something that has passed the test. So in effect, what he's saying is, just as mankind has put God to the test and has found him unacceptable, found God not passing the test as being worthy to have in our understanding, God then abandoned them to their adokimos, not dokimos mind. That is, in effect, that those circumstances have put man's mind to the test and it hasn't passed. Man's mind has proved defective. Now, he doesn't mean mind. He doesn't mean my equipment. He means my judgment, my reasoning, my how I form my beliefs. In my depravity, I have suppressed the truth. I have suppressed the truth, and therefore, what am I doing with my mind? That's the issue. What am I doing with my mind? Am I doing with my mind what it was intended to be done with it, to find, discover, and seek the truth? Or have I done something else with my mind? I've made up lies and fables and tales to tell myself, and it's the latter. So I pass the test. I mean, I fail the test, because that's not what a mind should be. So again, God abandoning them to their, and I just translate it defective mind, but God abandoning them to their defective mind is simply God letting us go into our foolishness and our folly. He didn't wipe us off the face of the planet. He didn't immediately, miraculously heal me so that I'm no longer a rebel. He just let this rebel go and take my rebellion to its logical consequences. The net result of all that, notice the pattern, just as in 10, what did we do? We rejected God. How did God respond? He let it go and abandoned us, and then describes the net result of him letting it go. What's the net result of him letting it go and letting us live with our folly and our foolishness and our fairy tales that we make up for ourselves? We were filled with all unrighteousness, evil, self-exaltation, and wrongdoing. Excuse me. I looked long and hard to find some kind of distinction between the Greek words for unrighteousness and evil and wrongdoing here. And it just, the way they're used in the New Testament, from best I can determine, they're basically synonyms. I mean, the same way that we do in English, to talk about something being wrong or bad or evil or wicked, we don't mean some fine distinctions between the two. You don't get an argument, no, I think that was evil and not wicked. You know, we don't have those debates or those conversations, because we know that they're basically just roughly the same thing. The one that stands out is the one that I translated self-exaltation. The Greek is pleonexia. Pleonexia is usually translated greed. And it caught my attention because I was looking at this. It looks like what he's doing here is just stringing synonyms together for overall overarching evil. So what's the overall arching evil? Unrighteousness, evil, wrongdoing. So what is a specific evil doing in the smack dab in the middle of that list? Greed. As I looked at that word a little bit, it looks to me like greed oftentimes can mean greed in the narrow sense, but it can be expanded. I mean, it means to be grasping after something, you know, to want something for yourself. So I called it self-exaltation, because if you go back to the garden, I think what Paul is talking about is if you go back to the garden, what is it that Adam and Eve were after? They were after displacing God in their life. They were envious of the role that God had in their life, and they kind of wanted to play that for themselves. They wanted to be their own gods. And I think in this case, pleonexia is intended to try to capture that aspect of all human evil, if you will. I mean, all human evil, no matter what form it takes, is in a sense that desire to replace and displace God in our lives. So he uses pleonexia, I think, to describe that. And then he goes on to give a whole long string of examples. I think it would be very profitable someday to take each of those, you know, word by word and reflect on them and analyze them and see if we can get some moral teaching about, yeah, exactly how does unrighteousness manifest itself in our lives. But we would spend from now probably till the Lord returns going over this list if we did that, so I'm not going to do that. Maybe someday it'd be a great thing for you to look at on your own. But in terms of the argument, it doesn't matter in terms of the argument of Romans, because in the argument of Romans, simply what he's saying is all that junk in your life is just rooted in the fundamental underlying depravity of every human being. at the fabric of our being, at the foundational structures of our being, we are evil. And all this stuff comes out as a result. Then he makes one last point here. While they understand the demands of God's justice, that people who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do they do these same things, but they also grant approval to those who practice such things. Two interesting points here. One, the fact that we are going to be condemned, and we know we are going to be condemned, we know we are damnable for being these kinds of people, is no deterrent. So that's how hell-bent we are on rebelling against God, is that we don't even, you know, our whole perspective is damn the consequences. I don't care. I just want to be who I want to be and practice what I want to practice and do what I want to do. Just damn the consequences. It doesn't matter what God does. I'm going to rebel against him. So that's how deep this goes, he says. And then also, not only do they do these same things, but they also grant approval to those who practice such things. It's one thing to think of human evil as just a kind of selfishness. It's one thing to think of human evil as I want what I want, and I am willing to make some compromises to get it. If I have to hurt you to get what I want and to enjoy what I want to enjoy, I'm going to do that. And certainly much of human evil manifests itself in exactly that kind of way. But what Paul is saying is, but you can't even make the excuse that human evil is just selfish. It's even deeper than that. It's even more depraved than that. If I see other people living out their depravity in a way that gives me no advantage whatsoever, I find myself celebrating and applauding them in their depravity. Now, again, remember, that doesn't mean all of us. But if anybody out there celebrates any depravity, what does that say about who I am at the foundational nature of my being? So by the time he's done with paragraph 11, he's tried to make the assertion, and it is an assertion, not an argument, to make the assertion, we, every last one of us, are thoroughly damnable creatures. There is no way in the world any one of us should be granted life in the kingdom of God. We're not worthy of it. We're not deserving of it. We're not even fit for it. We don't belong there. What we deserve is to be punished, destroyed. That's what we deserve. So, in terms of the argument of Romans, why is he making that point? Because it leaves us at the end of part three with the conclusion that there's no way at all that any human being who is a human being could possibly be granted life unless God acted in mercy toward them. And that then is going to become the foundation for the whole rest of his argument. It then becomes a given, starting into part four, that it's mercy we need. And then the question that gets taken up is, so who gets mercy? Who is it that's going to receive this mercy from God? So 12 is a great restatement of the purpose of this whole part 3. So you stand without a defense, O man, every one of you who passes judgment. For insofar as you condemn the other person, you bring condemnation upon yourself. For the one who is passing judgment is practicing the very same things, and we know that the just sentence of God is rightly and truly upon those who are practicing such things. That's where he wanted to leave us. And then the unspoken interlude is, so we need mercy, don't we? I'll open it up to your questions here. Just one last, final comment. Notice that with idolatry, homosexuality, liars, murderers, all this kind of stuff, it is so easy for us to, because we have been civilized and enculturated in a certain set of values and have certain personal values, to think of ourselves as better than those people who are less civilized and more criminal than we are, more antisocial than we are. I don't care what the sin is. Paul's perspective is every sin of every human being indicts me. So there's no room for arrogance. There's no room for self-righteousness. There's no room for a sense of moral superiority. That is utterly inappropriate. Which is not to say that we allow everything and tolerate everything and accept everything as valid. Quite to the contrary, we accept the whole thing as invalid. We are born invalid and we remain invalid, and wisdom is coming to recognize how invalid it all is. Everything we do, everything we think, everything we say is tainted in some way or another by human depravity. None of it makes any sense. None of it is right. None of it is what God intended. But we're all in the same boat, and it's important that we not forget that. We're indicted. We're all indicted with the sin of every other human being. Okay. How about your comments or questions?
Question. When you talk about us being made of the same stuff, It reminds me a little bit of the philosophical concepts of being of the same substance and the same having the same essence, which then, in my mind, kind of draws the connection to the debates over who Jesus actually was. And so then the question would be, to what degree was Jesus of the same stuff, and how was he not of the same stuff, and how is that related to him being tempted?
Well, I'm using the stuff metaphorically. I don't know. I don't think I'm capable of philosophically analyzing human beings in terms of essences and substances and that kind of stuff. I'm not smart enough. So when I talk about stuff, I just mean whatever it is that makes a human being characteristically and distinctively a human being, however that works out metaphysically and ontologically, that's what I'm talking about. And I think that's mostly how the biblical authors use their language as well. I mean, anything where they talk about a nature would be metaphorical rather than metaphysical. But notice that, let's see, later in Romans, he's going to talk about Jesus coming in the likeness of sinful flesh. So to answer your question directly, I think Paul's perspective would be, no, Jesus wasn't made of exactly the same stuff. It was only the likeness of the stuff of Adam, only the likeness of the stuff of you and I. But it was sufficiently... but it was our stuff insofar as our humanity, our created humanity goes, but not insofar as our depravity goes. So I'd make a distinction there. His stuff didn't include depravity, but it did include humanity, and ours includes both.
So I guess the thing for me is you talked about the two levels, sort of the upper level being like how civilized we are in a sense, And then the lower level being, you know, the fundamental depravity. So are you saying that at that lower level, that's where he was fundamentally different?
Yes.
Okay, and so then I guess the question is, because a lot is made upon or based upon, you know, Jesus' role and what he did and did for us, and why he was capable of doing that is because he was able to be tempted, just like us, and understood temptation, but he was resisted it or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a common sort of theme in a lot of Christian ideas, and I just wondered, to what degree was that temptation actually?
I think the temptation happens at the level of my humanity, that he faced the same pressures in the sense that hunger was hunger, stress was stress, fear was fear, anxiety was anxiety for Jesus just as much as it is for you and I. And so he faced all the same pressures that he had to deal with. What he lacked is that rebelliousness that gave him the propensity to deal with all those things in a perverted and sinful and unrighteous way. It comes naturally to us to deal with it in a perverted and unnatural way. It did not come naturally to Jesus to do that. Now, could he have done so? Yeah. I mean, it would be logically possible, it would have been metaphysically possible for him to sin. But it would have been outside the range of God's purposes for him and outside the range of his own commitments for him to do that, so he didn't. And he lived a sinless and perfect life, not because as a human being, he didn't have the potentials that human beings have to rebel against the creature and sin, but just because he was what I'm not, a good human being and not an evil human being. So.
Hi, Jack. Hi. I'm not sure if I've got a question or a comment, and I think your closing words clarified this in some respect, but as I was listening, I was struggling with this the we-they issue, and looking through it, it's there in Paul's words, but that the we as Christians is those who have, if I'm, this is not in your translation, just in the Bible itself. sorry. Maybe that's my point. No. Verse 17, that we live by faith. So the we is the community of faith. And then in as chapter 2 gets going, sorry, this is a little complicated, it's the sense that I think you ended up with as well, that we are all just as deeply depraved, guilty, invalid, etc.
Right.
But then there is this we day, in the sense that we, within the community of faith, and as you were describing sort of the propaganda out there about what we're supposed to think about this and that, I guess my only struggle, my question is one of sort of where we draw the lines, and I think at some point we don't know, but we are within the community of faith, those of us here, generally speaking. That doesn't mean God has let everything in our lives run to hell, but it also doesn't mean that he intervenes in every piece in our lives such that we're all here with all sorts of this stuff going on.
Absolutely, yeah.
And within, like, the propaganda thing, I would say, in my experience, there's tons of propaganda within us, or there's tons of groupthink within any community of faith where it's always easier to agree with the people around you than to say, wait a minute, I'm not sure, or what about this? And I guess I'm just raising that issue in that sense of we've all got all the sin that is being described in the they, and we have, including the propaganda. And maybe how is it that, maybe my question or my encouragement is, how is it that we as people within the community of faith can be gracious with each other, both with all our sin, but also maybe within areas of thinking when our thinking might not line up all the time with each other?
Preach it, sister. No, that's absolutely right. I mean, we have done a horrible job in Christian culture with that. Within the last several years, I've seen a couple of circumstances in church where it really comes down to the very concept of what a church is. Is a church a group of people who have found the truth, know the truth, are going to be champions of the truth, and are going to marginalize everybody else and damn them to hell? Or should the church be a community of people who are continually learning, continually growing, and continually seeking? And where the propaganda and the groupthink comes in is the whole concept that we need to close ranks and we need to decide that we've already arrived at the truth, we know what it is, and there ain't no more seeking going on. Don't you dare be looking. We already know what to believe, so let's believe this together. And in all soberness, there are people who would defend that concept of the church.
But that's not even Christian culture. I mean, that's human culture.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In the sense that it's here and that we do it with each other and within our own selves. We believe things or stick to things perhaps just because it's easier or...
Right. Preaching.
Thanks.
Hey, Brian, can I mention what I'm reading? I'm reading Brian's thesis. Brian Taylor's thesis he did, his master's thesis he did for his degree at Regency. It is a cross-history, cross-cultural look at humankind's interaction with nature, what nature is trying to tell us, and the religious structures that we create around that. It's fascinating. I think it would deserve a Charlie Rose type conversation among the community. And it has reminded me of this question. I waffle between a hard and fast cynicism and a soft grace towards pagan expressions and pagan pursuits in their religion. And, I've read C.S. Lewis and his comments about that, and I'm trying to, especially as I read Brian's paper, I'm trying to determine when we are genuinely making an honest mistake in our efforts to pursue God based on just what we know, feel, have been taught, and when we are deliberately creating an obfuscating edifice, so to speak. I tend to think when I look at quote-unquote false religions that they are deliberately brick and mortar building a wall between you and God and painting their own picture that they want you to love on it. And it's hard for me not to say BS, BS, BS to everything I see that isn't clearly, explicitly the picture of the Gospels that I was raised with. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, even within Jewish religious symbolism, I see them using Egyptian and Babylonian and a lot of imagery that's clearly not made up on the spot with no reference to their own past and the legends and myths that they were exposed to. So how do I walk in that those two views where I look at some quote unquote holy man and say you're an idiot, you're deliberately turning your back on God and encouraging other people to do the same, as opposed to the person I say you're onto something, keep looking.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking out loud here, but it seems to me that two things are true, that if what Paul is saying here is true about how depraved we are, how fundamentally in rebellion against God we are, then your conclusion only makes sense, that what else would religion be except a way of alienating us from the true God and distracting us with alternatives rather than taking us to the true God. And fundamentally, I think that's exactly what they are. That's the role they are intended to play. But God is so compelling that human beings can't help but tell the truth even in the lies they tell themselves. That is, there are moments of truth, insights. You know, the whole thing is intended to be a lie that we buy and get distracted from it. But in the process, they have seen, have understood, have had insights into the nature of the way things really are and the God who really is there. So I think the way we can use such writings is to simply evaluate each insight for itself. Is that not compatible? Is that helpful in understanding the God who really is there, or is it not helpful? And the fact that we would find some of those insights helpful shouldn't surprise us, because he says, God is known by the things that have been made. Well, why wouldn't they have insights into God and the true God in what they have seen? As long as they can wind it into a system that helps them escape responsibility to God, that's fine with them. They don't mind saying some true things along the way. So abstract the truth, throw away the junk, and throw away the whole worldview. If you want a comprehensive worldview, we're only going to find it in the Bible, not going to find it anywhere else.
So can the eternity in our hearts survive the depravity? Can it coexist with the depravity in our hearts?
I'm not sure I understand that question.
In Ecclesiastes, mm-hmm. in their hearts, and it seems to me that drives us towards that search. Can that be snuffed out?
Yes, I think so. Well, just stuffed out.
Inhuman for that to be extinguished?
I wouldn't put it past us. I think we could. And in a way, yeah. But within another system, another worldview, can the draw of God, the Creator, transcend all the lies and myths and misperceptions that exist in that other worldview? I think so. I think if God wants you, nothing's going to stop him. So you are, true believers are always going to be bad religionists. True believers are going to be bad Hindus and bad Buddhists and bad Muslims and bad Christians. If you are a true believer, you're not going to be you're going to be a suspect Christian, because you're interested in something else. You're interested in God. You're interested in truth. You're interested in goodness and where that stuff takes you.